Humanity is the human race, which includes everyone on Earth. It's also a word for the qualities that make us human. It is the ability to experience love, feel sorrow or loss, understand anger, but not to forget to have compassion and creativity. It's amazing and exciting to see the human emotions growing in a child as they become an I being. The I being and self-awareness is terrifying to see growing in a computer or being discarded as unnecessary. Witness the new struggle for self-definition. Words taken from the Enigma Chronicles, the Enigma Beyond the Enigma series, book 11 is where I'm citing that particular routine, created, of course, by a fabulous dynamic duo of souls who have been key parts of the program in times past. Of course, we're referring to the superb writing team of Charles Brakefield and Roxanne Berkey. And Charles is back with us for a third time. Last time was, of course, in March. So nigh on half a year later, Charles, welcome back to the Midweek Drive Author of the Week feature. How are you?
I'm good, Alex and Bright. I just very pleased to be back on and listening to your highly spirited conversation and your profound wisdom. I was sitting there listening to that quote. I thought, golly, who wrote that? I went, oh, you know, it's moi.
Of course. And of course, Jessica Burtis, who we haven't met before, because I think we connected you with Kathy Mann. So Jessica is back with us, a regular on the slot, etc. But I know very keen to quiz you about not only the whole world of tech spy journalism and indeed novel writing, etc., but also some of your new routines in the Enigma field as well. So actually, Jessica, let's turn straight to you. Would you like to throw a few questions at Charles about life, times, and how in so many ways he's predicted the plot to the last Mission Impossible movie, the hardest movie, the artificial intelligence, battling against human beings, even arguably what's happening in China, and indeed the whole essence of the Ukraine and more. Jessica, over to you.
I have so many questions that I would love to ask you. This is such a fascinating topic. But I think I just have to ask first, of course, but how did your interest in AI and technology really start? Was it a love for sci-fi as a child? Was it an Asimov book? I'd love to know.
Well, I'm a technologist by trade for the last 25 years. I've seen technology come and go. And so it's very much a revolving door of new products, new technologies, new sales pitches coming through. And this one, when it started to surface about 6-7 years ago, I started looking at it and went, I'm not sure if we're all ready for this. Some of the technology that, full disclosure, I have used some of the artificial intelligence application edges for some of the security products in real world, discovery. Applying it, pushing it, is where we typically, Rox and I, start looking at what if the guardrails weren't in place before somebody said, hey, let's see if we can do this before we figure out we should do this. And so that's where we start to stretch the fabric of the time-space continuum, and it looks like we're predicting the future. That's the spooky part when that stuff starts to happen. That's like, hey, you know, we said this was science fiction and it's more science fact than we expected. So, it's a growing concern, and it's looks like it's grown legs and taken off in some places where some people say, oh, it's no problem. In other places, it's like, get the fly swatter out. We're going to beat this to death. So, it's a very, as the Chinese would say, may you live in interesting times.
I think you make an excellent point too, that so much of technology has its origins in like creative arts and how people thought of this in books like Bradbury predicting so many different devices. So I think that that's a really good point, how often literature kind of predicts the progress of technology. How did you get started with writing?
Rox and I bumped into each other a couple decades ago at a place we were working together, and we left that particular job, their choice, not ours, and we ended up at a very nice place that was leading edge everything. I mean, we got to play with all the technology toys and write about them. Part of the deal was that when you're in professional services, people bring you on site. Here's my problem. Tell me what to do to fix it, and what do I need to buy? So that was always the primary driver for an output of a white paper. Says, here's your recipe, and then from there, then we would there'd be more sales, more consulting, blah blah blah, all that kind of stuff. But we found that we enjoyed the writing aspect of it. She got a writing gig with Auerbach to write technical manuals, and so we did white papers for them, two books. And the troublesome part about that is that they're out of date as soon as they get printed. That's why you see, edition number 45, because people are trying to keep it relevant and up to date, and the struggle is just monstrous. So I got mad. I gathered up all my marbles and stomped off and said, I don't play anymore. And then a couple months later, she's come to lunch. She goes, new deal. You're going to like this. New deal. Let's do fiction. We'll bake in the technical facts behind it. We don't have to do updates on a regular basis. And I went, I don't know. I wasn't quite sold on the concept. Then she said, this was the deal clincher. She's fantastic at clinching deals. She goes, we can kill people and not go to jail. So, with that, and in her court, though, we've produced whole books in the Enigma book series. We've started another one called Enigma Heirs, and we've even branched off into. I got two books in the background here for a cozy mystery series that we were invited to attend as guest authors and contribute to the series, and we got. Our second book is just hit the stands in August of this year, and it's uses some of the characters that we've pioneered in the Enigma book series. They tend to slip through, slip out, and go into different books that we like to cook.
One of the regular questions.
Typically prefer. Oh, sorry.
Carry on, Jessica. It's okay.
I just wanted to ask. I was curious. Since you started writing fiction later, I was really curious if fiction is typically what you prefer to read, or if you do like to stick to more technological journalism and nonfiction.
There's actually a very, very well-known author that I admire, and he once said, the difference between fiction and nonfiction is that fiction has to make sense. So I tend to stay with that with the fiction fictional stuff, and we put in the technical facts, and we can make life come out the way we want. Whereas in nonfiction, it's really hard to get it to come out exactly the way you want.
One of the most popular questions, Charles, that we've started asking an awful lot of our authors over the last few months since the advent of the fourth incarnation of ChatGPT, which apparently has an IQ of 150, which is just about 5 points below Albert Einstein's IQ, and subsequently going to be replaced shortly by ChatGPT version 5, with version 6 coming through in 2024, is quite simply how are we actually coping with that? It certainly has panicked the major studios. It's panicked the world of education. This year at the University of Lincoln, we certainly have included in terms of our rules and regulations for students the notion of any incarnation of unauthorized, it has to be said, any unauthorized use of artificial intelligence will be punished in the same way as plagiarism will be punished as well. There are a number of strategies that we're putting into place, one of which is we actually ask the students to produce an essay on a topic using ChatGPT, and then to actually critique the ChatGPT essay that they've actually had produced for them, to actually, in a sense, have a meta narrative. But that's, in a sense, just a small drop in the ocean in terms of how things are going. From your own perspective, given that clearly huge novels can be churned out and so on, Is this something that concerns you? Is this something that you actually say, no, the human spirit will survive, we'll get through it? Or is it a case of, well, we need to work together?
I tend to favor the work together. I don't see it, once the genie is out of the bottle, you're not going to put it back. Can you intercept it? I can see the, well, I mean, book 11, the thing that you quoted from, The Enigma Beyond, the AI wars, who's going to win? It'll be an ongoing competition, struggle. We ourselves, Rayfield and Berkey, actually had, we contracted with a company that claimed we can do you marvelous book reviews in, you know, days, hours even sometimes. And it won't cost but, you know, $20. Okay, let's try it out. I mean, for $20, I mean, that's, you know, that's, you know, four trips to the coffee shop. Let's go ahead and do it. He got back in about 7 days, a marvelous review, absolutely marvelous, for somebody else's book. They had pirate, basically, I'd spot it right away. It was not even clever, because we had sent the synopsis along with them to be able to kind of give them a flavor for what was, they didn't even quote anything out of the synopsis. They had raided our website for user IDs, character IDs, concepts that were not of the book that we'd sent them. And we called them on and they went, if you're familiar with the Jetsons and the dog Astro, they did the classic ruh-roh, and said, we'll give you your money back. You know, we'll have the person who did this killed. You know, we'll, you know, please, please don't take your business away from us. You know, and apparently they'd done the same thing for at least 8 other authors in that short period of time. And so there's always the mystique of the side hustle. Here, I'll go do the side hustle. We'll do reviews for people, crank them out. They won't know any different. Yeah, we will. So, you know, what's the word? You have to be vigilant. There's no way to be able to stop it. But at the same time, can you leverage it? We started putting on the bottom of our short stories and little publications we do through Medium. This is written by human beings, not an AI chatbot, and that's bragging rights. Not even you know, don't have I don't want to have it pollute my thinking. I don't want it ruining, and I don't want to have it be a crutch for, can't you write? Can't you come up with an idea? I mean, you know, I got a great idea from an actual event on Sunday, turned it into a nice little short story. So it's more of a you know, mindset. Can you defeat it? Well, let's talk. This is right at the heart of all of our books. It's the cyber good guys versus the cyber bad guys, and the bad guys are always ahead. And it's always about how to be able to defeat the bad guys and how long it takes the good guys to figure out the aha moment. So yes, it's a competition, it's a race. You can't legislate it away. You can't, you know, wave your wand and say, no, you can't use this. There's always somebody that's like, well, what if I did this? That's always that sneaky person from the dark net, the bad actor, that you just want to take them aside and leave them. So that's kind of the I'll get down off the soapbox now and, you know, stop railing so you can continue on with the show.
It's a perfectly valid statement, Charles, as Jessica will attest to. We've even started, as far as the program, the Midweek Drive Live is concerned, confirming that actually we are genuine human beings and we're not actually cyber ciphers and avatars that simply are actually used to get the point across from that point of view. And I've just popped in a kind of visual line, which if we ever release these things on YouTube, we'll actually sort of just emphasize that point from that perspective. Jessica, yeah. Back to yourself.
So what's next for you with your projects and your writing?
We've got a new episode in the Enigma Heirs series that we're working on. It's called The Enigma Forced, and it covers a lot of things that we see that are social problems, human trafficking, cryptocurrency is not really a social problem. It's more like a narcotic. I like watching it. I like studying it. I like knowing how it works. I've even got my own wallet, electronic wallet, and if I ever get enough nerve to be able to put anything in it, I'll finally get some value out of it. But it looks like a wonderful Ponzi scam of epic proportions, and apparently everybody from the dark net seems to know it. If you don't think so, there's over 3,000 different coins, stable coins, cryptocurrencies of every kind, and daily they are holding people in, arresting them for the Ponzi scams, for the cryptos that they're launching. Big name people, the FTX character that is struggling to stay out of jail. It's those are all proof points for not me, man. That ain't me, man.
Particularly interesting insofar as the rise of the finfluencer or financial influencer that an awful lot of folk are indeed falling victim to because of that, in a sense, negative side of the human spirit that does always believe that somehow there's a get rich quick scheme that is ideal for them, that actually, as far as they're concerned, this is the time where they will actually be successful. They won't be confused by the whole thing and they'll make it. And of course, that's how the criminal element will actually develop itself. And again, the term finfluencer, financial influencer, is now being used as a kind of standard way forward. Do you think the machines are laughing at us, Charles? Do you think that there's some way in which, if they get sentience, they'll actually say, phew, it's human beings? I mean, what?
That's a very interesting concept, humor. And if you start looking at it, like try to run the definition of it, it's really hard, and it's a really slippery topic. We actually cover that in book number five, where the our artificially enhanced supercomputer Ichabod is trying to understand and replicate humor in his knowledge banks. And it doesn't quite fit the programming model. I mean, how would you program something like that? They'd have to learn it, and then that's where you get back into, okay, how are you building the chatbots? How are you building the artificial intelligence stuff? And it's basically in its simplest form, probably a bit too simple, data mining. Basically, taking huge blocks of information, distilling it, ciphering it, pulling it through, and then pulling together patterns. And the easy thing that they do is like, okay, which one of these are cats? Which one of these are dogs? And that's where they start the beginning process for the chat GPTs, and the refinement for the algorithm of here's how you answer this based on this kind of input. But the flaw there is, okay, well, how do I get the information to come through and accurate? Oh, and by the way, who's grading the output of the artificial intelligence? If you're a machine, if you're asking it to do something that you can't do, how do you know you got the right answer? And that's one of those test points of like, if you can't answer it, then don't believe the output that you're going to get, because it's how do you know? And we actually covered that in one of our books as a proof point for the kids that are being taught that the supercomputer can be wrong, and you have to know how to do this yourself. And that's the piece that I would drive home in all of our books. It's like, are they laughing at us, Alex? They don't have a concept of at this point. They might be synthesized laughter. It may be, okay, if I see this, this line of words, I can pretend to laugh. Humor doesn't fall into that category. It's different between humor between males and females, different than generations. Humor is different between different cities, different governments. Something funny in the in France falls completely flat in Las Vegas. So there's no way to be able to accurately predict how this can be done with a computer, because We're back to, what are you teaching it? What are you feeding in? How do you generate this? And can you believe the output? And that's some of the things that they're struggling with right now, because it's like, well, my data set was so large, it encompassed everything. And it's, and I noticed the Chinese are actually got their version of the ChatGPT. And they fed some, I saw the some testing scenarios that they had done, trying to prove that it was as good as GPT. And they said, forgive me in advance, Jessica, for this this vulgar example, but they fed in, what's the best time for a woman to be married? And the Chinese one came back and said, well, she's got to be 20, between 20 and 23 before she goes to hell in the handbasket. That was the answer?
Not the best.
Yeah. Whoa. Just hold it there, I think, basically.
Yeah. All right. Well, more data, please. More data.
I mean, it's intriguing. In the 6 months since we last spoke, Charles, one of the things I've noticed has been the prevalence of the term AI in terms of mass advertisements targeting businesses and so on. Whether it's discover the power of AI in enhancing customer interactions with ChatGPT aspects, whether it's a case of using AI in applications for business and so on. And clearly, there is this sense that you need to embrace the technology. Are there any moments, given your technical background, that you are, if not uneasy, then a little bit wary? As you said, one needs to be constantly vigilant about the whole thing in terms of how this is being used. I mean, we see what Elon Musk is doing with X, of course, brackets, formerly known as Twitter, close brackets, and his suggestion of putting up a paywall so that everybody has to pay to use X. And to be honest, that'll be the moment where certainly at Southside Broadsea will cease to be on X, brackets formerly known as Twitter, because I don't really see the point or the purpose in terms of that. Any thoughts in terms of that? Or do you think we've just got to go with it and hope for the best?
We hit, in cybersecurity, which is something, an area I always, I'm always poking around in. The human element is still the weakest link in the chain. No matter what you throw at it, or what kind of technology you put in place, the human element is still can be socially engineered to say, here, let me have your password so I go ahead and fix this problem with your bank account. In other words, they're going to drain it. A true statement that the people, the coders at Samsung, who crank out the Samsung cell phone, the software that they run, one genius that they had there wanted to make his code even better, so he actually loaded it up onto ChatGPT to see if it could be made better. Does everybody know that ChatGPT is open source and anybody can see what you put out there? So he basically put proprietary code out there, you know, like a bonehead, and just like, here, help make it better. Wait, everybody's got it. Oh no, I made a mistake. So again, it's the human being that's like, you know, let the
maybe we should celebrate our pathetic nature, basically, Charles. Maybe it's the fact that we are flawed human beings. You know, thank the Lord for that. Praise the Lord.
Well, it's definitely it's a curse and a blessing. And for some people who have no self-awareness, it doesn't matter to them because they're always, you know, running into walls.
Charles, and actually run countries, so we have to ignore them as a matter of course.
So, yeah, we these are all the areas where, like, you know, how are we going to be able to defeat something that if you gave it unrestricted access to this, we get into the deep learning discussions with no guardrails and said, here, learn everything about this. Whoa, you know, I've seen you know, test cases where even Microsoft after 24 hours turned it off because it was filtering in so much stuff and vacuuming up every piece of hate thought that you could think of, and starting to spew it back out. So it's like, okay, these are the warning signs. You shouldn't be doing this. Don't know how you're going to stop anybody. Legislation? Oh, come on. The U.S. Air Force is already looking at how to be able to do pilotless aircraft for attack run by, you guessed it, artificial intelligence. I want to be someplace where I can, I can, when the explosion goes off, I can say, what was that? So, it's that's going to be some interesting times right around the corner, and sooner
Okay,
than what we thought.
you mentioned interesting times. We have an interesting question now, which I always refer to as Jessica Burtis's official nutrition question, which, being a citizen of Texas, you might kind of already be familiar with this, but it is something which we're gradually rolling out across the globe with authors around the world. Jessica, over to you.
Yes, I mean you're from Texas, so I know you've got to have at least part of this already. You already know it, but I like to ask people if they know and if they've ever tried some regional snacks of sweet tea and boiled peanuts.
Oh, I have not. I've tried many different things.
Wow.
Well, we will change that. If you gotta try some, maybe it can be in your next piece of writing. The AI can be starting a sweet tea empire. I can get behind
Okay.
that. Yeah,
Okay. I'll take that under advisement. I'm always interested in some something out of left field that like, what was that? Okay.
it's shocking.
I mean, I realize on your second appearance in the March, Charles, we were talking about looking for more evil geniuses or evil genius, perhaps if we're looking at the plural, I don't know, perhaps geniuses will be there. And you asked me to send in a CV. I haven't done it as yet, or resume in the case of the States. But in terms of the sweet tea, I must admit, I'm quite shocked. I mean, I really and had fully anticipated. I mean, I'm sure Roxy will have come across sweet tea and probably even boiled peanuts as well. But this is a significant moment, Jessica, I think.
Well, she doesn't like sweet tea, I can tell you that, because we have an author party coming up on Saturday, and the one thing she didn't want was sweet tea. So we have unsweetened tea and a big a sugar bowl for anybody that's that can't deal with the unsweetened tea. So there's half of it already. The answer is no on that one, and the boiled peanuts. Well, I'll have to ask that question.
There's
There's
still hope. There's hope.
yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, because otherwise, the Magnolia Bluff Crime Chronicles, as you say, a cozy version of the Enigma. I mean, is this the equivalent of Jessica Fletcher meets Miss Marple meets Columbo in an Enigma variation?
Well, and let me kind of rewind just a little bit on the series. What happened was we get invited to write the first series, the first book in this in that that series. We came in at number the fifth book, and that's the one on off my left shoulder here, The Flower Enigma. And we brought in two of our characters out of the Enigma book series, just to see how they would perform. It's a the concept is we built this this town, all the underground authors, and everybody gets to write. And use the characters, and we shift characters around. We borrow them from time to time. You have to be careful not to borrow somebody that's got whacked in one of the books. So you always ask before, can I borrow this one? They're going to be good. Okay, yeah, fine. But basically, it's the only people that really have full-time jobs are the coroner and the police department. So it's a it's Magnolia Bluff. That's the name of the other town, and it's like 15, 20,000 people, and we get
Like,
everybody gets their.
that's all I need to know. Is it like Cabot Cove and Jessica Fletcher, or is it completely different?
It's like any small town. Everybody knows everybody else's business, and there's always somebody that's that figures they can get away with some sort of crime, and it's sort of like a microcosm of the universe, if you will, but set in the Texas Hill Country, where we have 100 degree weather, or in your terms, it would be like 42 to 45 degrees Celsius for 60 straight days, and that can makes people a little edgy in this town. And
Tea.
yeah, and
Take
so
the
the yeah, So
It
the
might not be great for dental hygiene and cavities, but at least it'll reduce the murder rate.
Well, I mean that's as our catchphrase goes, people are just dying to get into the cemetery. So but the second season the second year we did The Killer Enigma with book number 16. That's off my right shoulder. And we brought those two characters back. They're marvelous young couple. She's a Brazilian supermodel, and he's a techno geek. And they finally got their romance on the right track together. And this is their first year in the Killer Enigma, back at the Magnolia Bluff at their favorite bed and breakfast, trying to get away from the paparazzi that she's that's always after her. They figure lightning won't strike at the same city twice, so we shouldn't have the same problem we had last year. That's the funny thing about Magnolia Bluff. There's always some sort of crime ready to be, quite literally, stumbled over, and so that's what this one's about. And it's got the two characters that we borrowed from the Enigma series because they're well fleshed out, and we know how they think. We know how to be able to put them into harm's way to make an interesting story.
I'm eagerly looking forward to when some of your characters will start emerging and developing their own cipher intelligence and cyber intelligence and crossing over in the Brakefield universe and so on, which can be a whole range of things from that point of view. You've got a fantastic website. Would you like to share with our listener how people can access it and all of the goodies therein, simply through the magic of actually subscribing and such like stuff?
Absolutely. So if you were to head to enigmabookseries.com, all one word, except for the dot, and there's a all of the ebooks are listed, all the trade paper are listed, all the audibles are listed. We're a firm believer in having all three of the medias. There are sample chapters for each one of the books. There are sample snippets from the audibles. We're quite proud of the voice actor who does the audibles for our series. He's an amazing individual to be able to keep track of our character universe, which somewhere over 150 characters at this point. But he
Actually
always
on
entertains. Yeah. And one piece of news for you that I didn't have for you last time we talked, folks, was that our screenplay. We have a screenplay that we've done on the our historical fiction out of Poland, and that has made the second round competition at the Austin Film Festival. That we'll be down there at in October to be able to take a look at and see how much further we can progress it. So we're quite pleased with the way that the series and the pre-series materials are evolving, and the attention that's being given to us. It's most gratifying. So wish us luck on that competition, and maybe we'll be able to when we come back next year, assuming that you liked us enough to be able to come back again next year. We'll have good news about the production, or no, we're still trying to shop that property.
strike going on in Hollywood. We need to have as many good scripts coming out there as possible.
Yeah.
So we'll get that sorted, I'm sure. Jessica, it's time for, I know astonishingly, the last two questions, which Charles may have recalled from his previous packages, but force your good self to deliver them. Over to you in North Carolina, despite obviously the challenge of having sweet tea turned down and not trying boiled peanuts. Over to you.
Charles, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
An interesting meeting with you. Is that what you asked?
Yeah, Zoomer.
I always enjoy talking with people. I get to talk about my favorite subject, our books, and there's I get quite animated. I probably have Yeah, I have been known to speak at, at 50 words a minute with a gust up to 200 words a minute. So I know I can be hyper enthusiastic from time to time. But yes, I appreciate the time to be able to visit with you too. Much you're like good friends that I don't get to see enough of. So permit me to say that I enjoy the time and we do get to talk.
I'm glad. Will you be joining us again soon?
I'd love to. Absolutely love to. We'll have a
No.
new book out coming out in the first quarter of next year. So that's about 6 months out. So perhaps that's a good time for, we need some filler over here. Where's that Brakefield character? We'll get him in on here again.
Nonsense. No, actually, we should have Roxanne back with us because Roxanne Berkey, of course, your co-author, was around back in August, the 5th, 2022. So it's fine. It's high time. It's well over, approaching nearly 2 years, really, since she was
Yeah.
last. So establish your
Well,
judgment.
that was my error. I sent the meeting invite after I got the time wrong to over to her, and then she put it into her personal calendar and not her work calendar. And somebody camped and they had the bad manners to have a customer meeting set up to all the time that we're supposed to be talking to you guys. So hopefully you're not disappointed with having to listen to me ramble. I will make sure the point of honor that she's on the next call.
Charles, it's been a delight. Take care. Keep on keeping on. And obviously, we look forward to the continuing Enigma and indeed productions from yourself and Roxanne. Cheers there.
Yeah. Alex, Jessica, thank you.
The importance of a ramble, very important. Not that we're rambling on here for too much, but an actual physical ramble, getting out and about and actually having a little wander across the whole routine. Well, it would seem that it's also good for our health because where numbers of heart attacks are at their highest, the number of walking paths are at their lowest. So, how can we actually address this notion of rambling towards equality for all? Well, we're delighted to welcome the head of paths at Ramblers, Jack Cornish, to the program to talk about this. Jack, how are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. How are you?
I'm okay. And I must admit, quite astounding to actually find that the current network of rambling paths provides an estimated 3,000 healthy years of life to the nation, which gives us a well-being value of around £2 billion. In other words, over £33 per person in England and Wales. So clearly, going out for a little ramble, even if it's a bit blustery and the conditions aren't great and you're wrapping up well, is good for our health.
Yeah, I think it's we at the Ramblers, we've had sort of paths in our DNA really for almost 90 years protecting places to go walking, and but we really want to understand what is the value of the network. And as you said, it's astonishing, the almost £2 billion a year just in well-being value. That doesn't even include things like tourism and the wider economic value of the network. So yeah, it's really fantastic to see the research we published today, and to see how much how much walking and how much our paths adds to the nation's well-being.
Now, we agree that it's a good thing to actually be able to ramble to work through that basis. However, another key insight about this report is the classic male, pale and stale, or possibly old, wealthy, white and healthy individuals who clearly actually have a lot more access to their local area than, shall we say, some of our inner cities, some of our other areas where actually there are many of our fellow citizens who would appear to be quite deprived when it comes to rambling paths.
Yeah, I mean, actually, yeah. So we see a real disparity in terms of what provision people have got. We looked at loads of different indicators. So, for instance, how many meters of public rights of way have you got within a 10-minute walk? How many have you got in a 20-minute walk? What percentage of those are green and paths? So there was loads of different indicators we looked at, but we definitely found some big disparities. I think it's worth saying that although obviously some of this is described by an urban sort of rural divide, actually it's not just that. So for instance, even in rural areas, the wealthiest rural areas have 15% more paths than some of the poorest rural areas. So there's still some of those differences to be seen there. And actually we found areas like Northeast Lincolnshire are some of the most deprived of paths in the country.
I was going to say that because initially people who attend Lincoln or come to Lincoln, they're often struck by the fact that you can literally have a wander along and you're in the countryside and so on, and it looks all great. But clearly there are areas here where, I mean, we spoke a few years ago about the right to ramble and the line with respect to that. I mean, is it just a case of, we don't have pathways that are clearly signposted, that we have areas and issues where people feel as though they're trespassing? And why is it that we have this disparity in terms of rambling zones?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think some of this is history, and some of it, to be fair, is landscape. So for instance, in further south in Lincolnshire, we see there's definitely less public rights of way, and obviously some of that's because of fenland landscapes. But actually, there's still fantastic places to go walking, and we want more connections through those areas. So there's a real, the actual picture looks, I think, a bit different in different parts of the country for different reasons. I mean, we if you look at the map of somewhere like Northeast Lincolnshire, some of the issues there, you've got fantastic, got the coastal path going through, which is brilliant, but it's some of the issues there, I think, are connections out from the sort of town to the wider countryside. So there'll be different issues in different parts of the country, and I think they necessitate different solutions in different parts of the country.
You've recently completed a 1,500, in fact, over 1,500 mile walk all the way from Land's End to John O'Groats. You joined the Ramblers in 2017, and of course, you're the author of The Lost Paths, a journey and exploration of the deep history of English and Welsh paths. In an era where clearly ChatGPT and driverless vehicles and cars and the 21st century is very much with us, do you feel as though we're losing that basic joy that actually employing Shank's pony, as it was once referred to,
Indeed.
can actually give us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually, I think there's a bit of a renaissance and a bit of a revival of walking going on at the moment. I think that obviously it wasn't a great time for many reasons, but during the pandemic, for instance, when we were, we had your hour of exercise a day, a lot of people went walking, and a lot of people explored their local paths and maybe did more walking than they had done before. And I think some of that has continued on, and it's really heartening to see people connecting with with the benefits of walking. But also, we've found at the Ramblers a massive connection with the paths themselves, and people being really interested in the history of the paths and wanting to reclaim those so they can be protected for future generations.
Now, you're also very much connected with the Don't Lose Your Way project. That's identified more than 49,000 miles of paths that could be lost forever because they're not legally recorded as public rights of way. Is this a challenge that our legal experts need to rise to? Is it a case of if we just stand by and do nothing, they'll be lost? What are we kind of looking for this?
Yeah, so we would love more volunteers to get involved with this. Essentially, these are paths that existed 120 years ago that have dropped off our map, and they aren't legally recorded, and they need to be. So they're on the ground and they're shown on the Ordnance Survey map, but also the legal protection means they'll be there for generations and generations to come. So what we'd love to do with Don't Lose Your Way is, if anyone's interested in the history of their local area, they like looking at old documents, that's what we need. We need people to be going through some of the old records, some of the old maps, to find evidence that these paths were used by the public in the past, and therefore they should be public now. And there's many paths to be reclaimed. It will make a massive difference to our walking network, where we can go walking. But it also it safeguards a really significant, and I think often overlooked, part of our heritage.
Is there a way in which the listener can actually get actively involved? Do they need to sign petitions, or is it a case of just exercise their right to ramble?
Well, I mean, one thing, yeah, definitely, we'd love people to go walking more and go out walking. But if people go to our website, ramblers.org.uk, they can read the research. There's some really detailed reports there, but also they can read the summary. But actually, we'd also love people to get involved with volunteering. And so, for instance, just in the path world, as I said, we'd love people to do some historical research. We've also got people that sort of lobby and campaign locally for their paths, but also get out on the ground and go and clear paths. And they go and cut back vegetation and replace stiles for gates or gaps, if even better, to make paths more accessible and to make sure that more people can get out walking.
And you mentioned that because obviously that's part of the role of our Ramblers volunteer to keep paths clear and well maintained and so on. I was interested to see you also put up waymarks to help walkers know that they're sticking to the right path. In an era where everything seems to actually be reliant upon satellite navigation, do you still feel as though those waymarks are still critical because not every part of the country has perfect coverage for our mobile phones?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that we definitely need better, and there's definitely issues on where some paths aren't waymarked at all. And I think, having clear signage on our paths means that you can have confidence to put your phone away and go for a walk and keep on following the path. And I think, that's fantastic. We want to go out walking to, don't get me wrong, I sometimes go with headphones in and some music and stuff, but we also want to go out walking to really get engaged with nature. And I think, better signage enables us to just follow the path and just see where it takes us. And actually, in theory, all of our paths should be navigable without maps. You should be able to follow the path through signage. Now, obviously, we know that's not the case in a lot of places, but we can definitely do better to signpost our paths.
Yes, I must admit, I've always been confused by folk who actually go out and actually plug in their headphones and so on, thereby disengaging from the very essence of nature that they should actually be engaging with as they're wandering through the process. But maybe that's just me being, bizarrely anachronistic on that
No,
side of
I
things
don't think
then.
so. I don't think so. I think, it's what do you say? Different strokes for different folks. It's and sometimes I'd say sometimes I do it, but actually most of the time I just want to, really bathe in nature. It's just that's what the path network gives us. It gives us a it's the foundation for a whole load of different experiences, and people might want to go for 10 minutes, they might want to go for 5 hour walk, and they can do it in loads of different ways, and that's fantastic that it's there for everyone.
And last year, of course, the Ramblers volunteers organised 40,000 group walks, and various partners organised another 30,000 short health-focused walks as well. So, clearly, the rambling thing is very important. Just share with us one more time, Jack, the best web address to go to find out more details about how folk can become involved with their local Ramblers association.
Sure, if you go to ramblers.org.uk, you'll find all the information there.
Jack Cornish, Head of Paths, Ramblers. We have to end with this. Happy rambling.
Happy rambling. Thanks very much.
Okay, the cost of living crisis. I know sighs all around, and we think, oh, not again. Is it any surprise that, of course, 27% of adults are struggling with their mental health because indeed of the cost of living crisis? Well, maybe to perhaps put some glimmers of hope into the ether to talk about the cost of living crisis and ways in which you can possibly actually address your fuel concerns as well. We're delighted to welcome two fabulous folk. First of all, musician and mental health advocate extraordinaire. It's the fabulous Professor Green. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. We also have our British Gas Energy Trust chief executive. That's Jessica Taplin. How are you, Jessica?
I'm very well, thanks.
Excellent. Professor Green, let's come to you first in terms of the sequence. Were you surprised by this research that, although people are actually showering less, not buying new clothes, cancelling subscriptions, limiting the use of household appliances, and even growing their own home produce, they still aren't making ends meet? There's still a challenge out there.
No, I think to be honest with you, because this isn't the first time I'm doing this, and for all the work I've done previously and the many, many people I've spoken to, I'm sadly not that surprised by the statistics. 27% of adults in Britain that are struggling with their mental health because of the cost of living crisis, which actually rises to 70% of 18 to 24 year olds and 52% of 25 to 34 year olds. So to be that impacted at that age is horrific, isn't it? And the things you just mentioned. Sounds post-war, doesn't it? Or perhaps mid-war. Doesn't sound like something that should exist in our day and age. People are reducing everything they possibly can. And I think there's many how well, not think, I know there are many households which have never encountered poverty before. A third of all households in England now live through poverty and are dealing with these cutbacks that they're trying to make, and then still after having reduced everything they possibly can. Looking at the numbers in front of them and still seeing a negative and just not knowing how to proceed. So I think there's a real importance around these British Gas Post Office pop-ups and the British Gas Energy Trust and the work that's being done by way of research and mapping in the communities that need it the most.
It does seem almost Dickensian in terms of the description. I mean, Jessica, from your own viewpoint. I mean, this notion, which again, what Professor Green has just described there, is something which you could have actually seen maybe in the days of the 1850s and Victorian England, where we were having extreme poverty in the cities and so on. You might have had that side of things there. Is this something which, again, you share the concern that has just been raised?
Absolutely. So our purpose as a trust is to help try and alleviate the detrimental impact of poverty. And our funding from British Gas has increased from sort of 6 million to 25 million over the past 3 years to help us do that. We currently fund 45 local money and energy advice charities who are in communities. But really, what we want to talk about today is the post office pop-ups, because there are so many issues facing people and a lot of them really struggle to know where to turn. It's really difficult to know where to turn. And this is why the pop-ups are being launched again. This is our third year to ensure that there is support if people are struggling.
Yeah, and I think the important thing to highlight from that as well is that the British Gas Energy Trust are working with charities that already exist in these communities, which offers a level of trust between the charities and the people in that community because of their understanding of the specific needs of that community and the relationships they have already built up with people in it, which I think is really important because there's a lot of shame that comes with poverty. And a lot of isolation and a lot of not wanting to offer up how, you know, just the gravity of your situation and how substantial it is. And as always, things are going to feel entirely unmanageable and a hell of a lot worse unless you do talk to someone about this. And with the post offices already existing as a hub of most communities, I think it's great that people can walk into one of these British Gas post office pop-ups and be afforded privacy to talk to a money and energy advisor and be, you know, help to look at things as a big picture. This isn't just looking at one aspect of their lives or, you know, their bills. This is looking at absolutely everything and helping them look at everything from benefit eligibility to energy use to debt write-off and to work out how they can best proceed.
Now, these post office pop-ups, which you've described, are obviously taking place across the UK between September and 2023 and March 2024. How will people actually know whether their post office is actually participating in this? Is there a sign? Is there an indication? What's the best way of actually knowing whether they can find things in their area, Jessica?
So they can have a look at our website, britishgasenergytrust.org.uk, and that'll let people know if there's a post office pop-up near them. We'll be running 50 between now and March across 11 different communities. If there isn't a post office near you, though, please do have a look at other support. There's a bounce back checklist and there's also grants available.
Professor Green, from your own perspective, do you feel as though, again, this is a very laudable and very important initiative, but do you feel that even more really needs to be done?
Yes, of course, because as Jessica highlighted, this exists in 11 communities that are most in need. That doesn't account for every community that is in need. So I think it does, obviously, but I think this is a great initiative. And it's if this didn't exist, things would be even worse. But it's important that, you know, things do grow to be able to support people on a wider scale.
And Jessica, clearly the British Gas Energy Trust has as one of its key aims the concept of helping people avoid the burden of energy debt, make informed energy choices, and to improve their money management skills. Again, do you feel as though as we run these awareness issues that people will be able to engage with this process? And the key thing that we've talked about today is literally to communicate, not to actually allow these problems to fester. If you are having challenges, go and seek help.
That is so right. There are lots and lots of people and households in that situation. And before winter really does hit, we would encourage you to seek help. You're not alone. There's people who will be struggling exactly like you. The advisors we fund 45 charities on top of these 11 charities doing the pop-ups. So there is help available and they will just listen to you. They'll help you work through your issues as a person, as an individual, and try and find the right path for you to decide to go upon.
And a reminder, where can people actually go to find out further details about what we've been discussing today?
BritishGasEnergyTrust.org.uk to find out all the information.
Professor Green, ACE musician and mental health advocate, and of course, Jessica Taplin, British Gas Energy Trust Chief Executive. And many thanks indeed. Stay warm, people.
Thank you.
Thank you.